Hi, everybody. My name is John Beck, and with my friend Kurt Dewhurst, I co-director Daily Work of Daily Lives. I want to talk about coming attractions and then get on with today's brown bag. We actually have two more brown bags in March. Now, ultimately, we have one more in April, and then we will be down for the season since it will be the end of the school year. Next Tuesday, Jacob Zumoff, who's with the History Department at New Jersey City University, will be talking about his new book on Passaic Textile Strike, 1926, Helen, New Jersey, Women, Communism in the 1926 Passaic Strike. And his new book just came out. It's called Red Thread, that looks at that strike. So we're going to be very happy to have Jacob here. Then Liz Pfau comes back, and Liz is the ex-head of the history department at Wayne State and really an unbelievably talented scholar. Much of her work has looked, as a labor historian, has actually looked at occupational safety and health. So she'll be talking about rediscovering work can be dangerous, occupational health and safety in the long 1970s. And many of us remember, those of us who were around at that time, that it was Richard Nixon's administration that actually signed, Richard Nixon signed into law the OSHA Act. And so I'm sure that a lot of that is going to be in what Liz is going to have to tell us. Tonight, if anyone just can't get enough of Ted McClellan, we're actually going to be doing the Ari Olds lecture series at that point. And by just a reminder, all of our brown bag presentations are now via Zoom. So get a hold of me if you need the links for our coming weeks. Tonight is part of our Ari Olds lecture series, which happens about three or four times a year, depending on whether or not we have a major pandemic. So Ted's going to be doing that presentation from his home in Chicago like he's doing this one. But today, I'm very happy to have Ted here. This talk is co-sponsored by the Capillary Motor Cities Group, which is part of the Motor Cities National Heritage Area. And we have a group in Lansing that tries to push all things auto heritage, auto workers, auto communities, auto magnates, and the rest. And Ted is, I'm going to do an introduction more at length the minute I get off of sharing screen. But let me just say that he'll be talking today on the topic Midnight in Vehicle City, telling the story of the Flint sit-down strike. But let me stop sharing. And welcome you again all here. And I can tell you that, Ted, this is your second time in the Brown Bag series because you came and spoke about your earlier book, which I actually just adore, called Nothing But Blue Skies, that really looked at kind of a change in the Rust Belt from all the way from Buffalo and elsewhere points east through the Great Lakes. But today, Ted is talking about this book, which as I told him, I picked up at Everybody Reads in Lansing, where you can actually get a signed book plate from Ted, that they'll affix to your book. And Midnight in Vehicle City is the latest and potentially greatest telling of the Flint sit-down strike. Now, that's because of the fact that there has not been a major scholarly work since Sidney Fine's book Sit-Down long, long ago. And so it's amazing in a way that it's taken this long for a good full book treatment of the strike to get done again, because it's a story that deserves to be told, which we're going to hear today from Ted McClellan. Ted is a historian, journalist, and currently his new project, he told me the other day, is he's looking at Lincoln and Douglas in Illinois, which has been his adopted state for a long time. But by background, Ted is actually a Lansing, was raised here, went to high school across from the Verlinden plant, which was replaced by Lansing Delta Township, so local 602 of the UAW. And Ted's book is what often would be called a popular history, which means that it's longer on the story than it is on the footnotes, which is often not the case in academic publishing. So I hope that this book gives great prominence to the strike. And my job today, we decided that we're going to do this almost as an interview rather than anything else. But I'm going to start off with a first question for Ted, which is, why do a book on the 1937 sit-down strike? Why this book? Why now?
Okay. Well, you should also have mentioned that I am a Michigan State graduate.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
I'm a Spartan. And yeah. I like to say that I started my professional writing career at Lansing Community College, because the LCC Lookout was the first publication that ever paid me for a piece of writing. I think it was 12 and a half cents a column inch or something like that. So anyway, okay, why a book about the Flint sit-down strike? Well, you know, you mentioned Sidney Fine's book, and that came out in 1969. And, you know, that was just such a very different moment in the history of Flint and the history of the middle class, of the auto industry, the labor movement. You know, I think there was a feeling, as he wrote the book, or a feeling at that time, that the gains of the sit-down strikers, you know, had been permanent. This was a time of unprecedented prosperity in America. I mean, to use an academic term, what you call the Gini coefficient of economic equality was at its all-time high in the late 1960s. And this was the time when, you know, any young man could just walk out of high school and get a job in an auto plant. And that happened at Sexton. You just walk across the street and go to work at General Motors. But I think that we found in the 50 years since that, you know, the gains of the labor movement have not been permanent, especially since the early 1980s, they've really been rolled back. I went to a White Shirt Day a couple of years ago. That White Shirt Day is the annual commemoration of the sit-down strike in Flint every February 11th in Flint. And they call it White Shirt Day. They all wear white shirts to show that they're just as good as the management. And there was a UAW vice president who said that most auto workers in America are now non-union, you know, because these foreign auto companies who've set up in places like Ohio and Tennessee and Alabama, those plants are not organized by the United Auto Workers. UAW has been unable to organize them. So that was one reason. We had a close family friend who was a sit-down striker, who was one of the last surviving sit-down strikers, a guy named Everett Ketchum. He was a 25 cent an hour apprentice when the sit-down strike started. He eventually moved to Lansing. His wife died, and then he married a woman who worked at Michigan State University, and he transferred to Oldsmobile, and he lived in East Lansing, and they owned a lot of properties there. They rented them out to college students. But he retired making $27 an hour, and he got lifetime health care, which I suppose is one reason he lived to be 98 years old. He finally died in 2013. And he was, to me, just exemplified the prosperity that the sit-down strike had helped bring to auto workers. And some people might know this anecdote. He kind of became a minor local celebrity. He was in the John Schneider column in the State Journal. They called him the Tooth Fairy, because he used to go to the Flapjack Shack over by Frandor, and one of the waitresses, you know, he noticed she kept covering her mouth. He said, "Why do you cover your mouth?" And he liked to flirt with waitresses. This was probably one reason he asked for that. And she said, "Well, look at my teeth. They're so bad." He said, "Well, how much would it cost to fix your teeth?" And she said, $14,000. So he wrote her a check for $14,000. This is the kind of money that he had made, that he had accumulated just working in the shop. So I think that the sit-down strike, established that auto workers were just entitled to the same benefits as anybody else. And I really think that he was a skilled tradesman. He became a tool and die maker. And I'm sure in the 70s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, that was the best job in town. I mean, even better than, you know, working for the state, because, you know, you got these lifetime healthcare benefits after you retire. And you can retire on full benefits after 30 years. There was the 30 and out provision that they won in that famous 1970s strike. So yeah, I think those were, and also you mentioned Nothing But Blue Skies, and I wrote about the sit down strike and Nothing But Blue Skies, but I just decided, you know, that book was just kind of about a lot of things, and it was kind of all over the place. And just as a writer, I wanted to take one incident out of there and write a narrative history of it, you know, just to use a book to tell one story, which is something I've always wanted to do, and which I hope to do from now on in my future books. I didn't really want to write another journalistic book. I wanted to move more in the direction of history.
So Ted, can you give us maybe just a quick overview, kind of a timeline of the strike, so that people can put it in their mind and in perspective?
Yeah, well, the UAW, they had broken away from the American Federation of Labor because that was considered to be more of a craft union, more of the aristocrats of the factories or of labor. And, you know, this was John L. Lewis, and he founded the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations. And then the UAW reorganized under the CIO, and they had a convention in South Bend, Indiana in early 1936, and they decided, you know, we need to strike GM, and we need to do it in Flint, because, you know, Flint was GM's hometown. Flint was where they made parts that were used in every GM car, in every GM plant. So if they could shut down Flint, they could shut down the whole company. And that was why they went after Fisher Body One, because that had the dies that were used to stamp out body parts that were used in every GM car everywhere. So they sent an organizer, a guy named Wyndham Mortimer. He was a communist. And this was another thing that Sidney Fine didn't talk much about in his book, was the communist leanings of the UAW organizers, because these guys were still alive, and this was in the middle of the Cold War, and I guess he didn't want to get him into too much trouble. But yeah, Wyndham Mortimer was a communist. And so he went to Flint, you know, checked into a hotel, and GM was just trailing him everywhere. And so he was holding all these secret meetings with GM employees. They would meet in basements, you know, they would meet in darkened churches at midnight. And he would, you know, ask the guys for a dollar, and he'd give them a card. And they wanted to time the strike after you know, this effort began in November. Frank Murphy was elected governor of Michigan. You know, he was considered a New Deal governor. He was an ally of Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was elected with the support of labor, and they wanted to time the beginning of the strike to the beginning of his administration, because they thought he would be more sympathetic than the outgoing governor, who is Frank Fitzgerald, who was from Grand Ledge. He might have been to Fitzgerald Park there. He was a Republican. And they almost made it, but right around, I think it was around December 30th, they got word that GM was moving some dies out of the plant and was going to send them to Grand Ledge. And of course, if they didn't capture the dies, if they didn't have control of the dies, and the plant would be kind of worthless. So as soon as they found out about that, the guy who'd taken over the effort, the organizing effort, Bob Travis, Mortimer had kind of been pushed out because too many people, they said he was trying to start a red empire in Flint. So his communist background kind of made him undesirable as an organizer. And I think he was eventually pushed out of the UAW entirely by Walter Reuther, because after World War II, Walter Reuther wanted to get rid of all the radicals in the Union during the Cold War. And so he said, tonight's the night. They had a headquarters, strike headquarters, right across the street from the plant. And I think that building is still there, and they had a red light, and they would turn it on whenever there was going to be a meeting. So all these guys went over there, and he said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to sit down. We're going to stop working. We're going to take over the plant. And It was actually about 10:30. My agent liked the title "Midnight in Vehicle City." He thought it sounded dramatic, so more so than 10:30 in Vehicle City. that's when the strike actually started, and it went on for 44 days. And at the end, GM gave in, and they allowed the UAW to negotiate on behalf of workers and all the plants affected by the strike. And after that, workers all over the country wanted to sign up for the UAW. They got thousands and thousands of new members. And eventually, shortly after that, they organized Chrysler. And Ford was a little bit of a tougher nut to crack because Henry Ford was very famously and violently anti-union. But eventually, they organized the entire American auto industry, and really, I would say, became the flagship union in the U.S. I had a UAW member once tell me, you know, we set the wages and the standards and the benefits for all the other industrial workers. People would stone us whenever we got a raise, but when we got a raise, everybody else got a raise.
So, Ted, you know, there was a good amount of violence in the strike.
Yeah.
But there was also, frankly, a lack of violence in the strike, meaning that it could have gotten very bad. That is, there was an injunction that the workers should be cleaned out of Fisher number one and number two. There was this whole notion, frankly, Murphy was one foot on a banana peel, the other on a roller skate in relation to handling how he could be a new dealer on the one side, believe very strongly in labor on the other, and then also deal with the whole issue of private property and the fact that these folks were occupying an actual plant. And, they did have the law on their side.
Well, I thought I would, we talked about this. I can read the part.
That'd be great.
The Battle of the Running Bulls, when the Flint police attempted to oust the strikers from Fisher Body Number Two, because as you said, they went to court and they got an injunction, and legally Murphy could have used his troops to enforce the injunction, but that's not what happened. Okay, on January 11th, the heat inside Fisher Two goes off at noon. In the middle of January in Michigan, the air is so cold that a man's nostrils flap shut when he draws a deep breath. Every exhalation manifests itself as a cloud of steam. Hands chap and redden. That day, the temperature tops out at 16 degrees. As the early winter chill seeps through the brick walls of Fisher 2, the 100 or so men inside realize the company means to freeze them out. Fisher 2 is situated on a rise just north of the Flint River. When the plant is running, 1,000 workers produce 450 bodies a day, which are shipped to the assembly line at Chevy in the Hole via viaduct that crosses Chevrolet Avenue. Since the beginning of the sit-down, the strikers inside Fisher 2 have spent their time playing cards, singing union broadsides, and keeping fit with daily rooftop calisthenics. But some have been preparing for the confrontation General Motors now seems about to incite. Fred Ahern, who installs trunk boards, fashions a blackjack by loading a leather pouch with lead. Men unload car door hinges from storage kegs, lining them up on windowsills to employ as missiles against a potential assault by the bulls, the plant guards, and police. To prevent a rear guard attack, they weld steel plates to the back doors and the doors leading to the overpass and roll auto body dollies against the vulnerable entrances. For the first 2 weeks of the strike, General Motors has provided heat to the strikers occupying the second floor of Fisher 2 and has allowed their wives to pass homemade ham, stews, bread, and pies through the windows. Gus's Cafe, a Greek diner with a big shop trade, donates meals. The plant guards inspect the care packages to ensure they contain new alcohol, then allow them past the gate. Every evening at 6 o'clock, a union delegation delivers supper from the strike mess. The 11th of January is different. That evening, the usual contingent of 8 company guards, led by Pete Peterson, has been reinforced by a 22-man detachment armed with clubs and led by the chief of the Fisher Body Plant Police. Around the same time, a contingent of Flint police is gathering a few blocks south of the plant, blocking traffic on Chevrolet Avenue. First, the guards carry off a 24-foot ladder the strikers have been using to clamber in and out of the second-story window. Then when the food arrives, the guards bar the door. Not only is GM planning to freeze the strikers out, it's planning to starve them out too. The company has been told by a Pinkerton spy who was part of the original occupation that there are only 100 men inside Fisher 2. It seems like an easier target than Fisher 1, whose striker population is 2 or 3 times greater. One of the sit-downers, Roscoe Rich, is standing at the front gate, a set of metal reinforced glass doors, when the food delivery is blocked. He runs upstairs to report the blockade to strike leader Red Mondale, who's working in one of the administrative offices. "Red, they stopped the food from coming in," Rich reports. "Who the hell stopped the food from coming in?" Mondale asks. "Well, Pete Peterson, he locked the door." "Well, you go and tell Pete Peterson you want the keys to that door. Either he opens it or gives you the keys. If he don't give you the keys, Roscoe, you take your flying squad and you bust that damn door in. That's all there is to it. Just go down there and tell him you want the keys." The flying squads are paramilitary units ready to rush to trouble spots. Word of the blockade reaches strike headquarters at the Pengelly building shortly after 6 o'clock. Janora Johnson is rehearsing a play there with her husband Kermit, her sister, and two friends. Hearing the strikers are being denied food and heat, they drive over to Fisher 2. Outside the plant, pickets singing Solidarity Forever march in circles on the sidewalk, pausing to warm themselves at kerosene-fueled salamanders. From a second-story window, a man shouts, "We're having a meeting and electing a committee to see about getting our meals through." The committee decides the method least likely to provoke a scrap with the guards is to pile food into picnic baskets and hoist it through the windows on ropes. At 8:15, Victor Ruther arrives from the Pengelly building in a sound car, accompanied by his brother Roy and a United Rubber Workers organizer from Akron. By then, the police have barricaded Chevrolet Avenue both north and south of the plant, but Victor is able to slip through the blockade via a side street. "Well, so they turned the heat off on you," Victor broadcasts through his loudspeaker. "So they shut off your food. They have talked of avoiding violence. Now they have taken the first step." Victor has brought along a phonograph. He asks the men if they want to hear some music. "No," shouts a club-wielding striker leaning through the windows. "We want action. Send a committee to the gate and tell those guards to open it up and turn on the heat," Ruther shouts back. With instructions from Red Mondale inside the plant and Victor Ruther outside, Roscoe Rich returns to the main gate with a 15-man flying squad, including Pete Pavlich, a brawler nicknamed Black Pete. They will break through the gate with brute force if the guards refuse to open it. Black Pete has prepared for this showdown by wrapping stick solder around his hands. Rich confronts Peterson, who is standing inside the locked main entrance to the plant. From the street, Victor Ruther issues a decisive command. "Take the gates." "Now you either open that door, Peter, or I'm going to open it," Rich demands. "I lost the keys," Peterson retorts. "I'll give you 3 minutes," Rich replies. Rich begins counting down. When he reaches zero, the flying squad surges past the unresisting guards and busts the locks on the doors. The strikers rush outside and mingle with the pickets on the sidewalk while the overwhelmed plant police seek shelter in a women's restroom. From there, they radio the Flint Police Department to report they have been captured by the strikers. Minutes after the strikers break through the doors, two columns of Flint police begin crossing the bridge from their positions on the south bank of the river. They're armed with tear gas and wrapped in bulletproof vests. Their faces hidden inside World War tear gas masks with goggle eyes and rubber snouts. The officers look like a platoon of bipedal insects. "Here they come," the pickets cry. Striker William Connolly is standing just inside the door. Gripping both ends of a blackjack he has threaded through the door handles, he braces his feet against the center post. Captain Edwin Hughes of the Flint Police commands the strikers to open the gates. He gets no response. Above the front door is a window reinforced with chicken wire. A police officer smashes the glass with the butt of his tear gas gun. Connolly thinks the weapons look like a pistol, but he also thinks he ain't got guts enough to shoot a harmless worker. The cop does have guts, firing a tear gas shell into the crowd of the lobby. The room where on ordinary work days, employees punch in for their shifts. The flame from the discharge singes Connolly's cheeks and temporarily blinds him. He drops to the floor and crawls backward on his knees, seeking the safety of the shop floor. Meanwhile, a team of strikers has hooked up fire hoses. They kick open the door and direct the nozzles at the police, who are still firing tear gas through the broken window. "By God," thinks Mondale, "we haven't got a lot to protect ourselves with, but if we can get these water hoses down, we will just wash them the hell out of here." Gas seeps in. Water gushes out. The spray knocks several officers to the ground. Mondale notices the canisters are still discharging gas. He orders the men with the hose to sweep it out the door. "Jesus, hit it with that water hose. Hit it with that water hose." From the open door windows on the second floor, strikers pelt police with door windows stockpiled for this moment. The tide of battle turns in the strikers' favor. The wind is blowing out of the north, wafting the tear gas back toward the police, who cannot advance into the cold, stinging spray from the hoses. Emboldened strikers surge out the front door and chase the retreating police toward the bridge, hurling any projectile they can lay their hands on. Hinges, bricks, nuts, bolts, milk bottles, shards of curbstone, even snowballs. The Stars and Stripes Forever blares from the sound car, a surreal patriotic soundtrack to the melee. The pickets join in the rout, smashing police car windows and overturning a Genesee County Sheriff's Department cruiser, which contains Sheriff Wolcott himself. "It was bad enough they turned my car over," Wolcott later remarks, "but they did it with me in it." When he emerges from his upside-down vehicle, Wolcott is struck in the head by a flying missile. He's one of 9 law enforcement officers injured that night. Others are set upon and roughed up by pickets and strikers. Fred Ahern tears an ashtray out of a police car and uses it to crown a cop who is beating a fellow striker with a nightstick. Halfway through their retreat toward the bridge, the police turn and open fire into the pursuing mob. "God damn, I got hit," Mondale hears a man cry. He turns to see the blood running down Hans Larson's leg, struck by a buckshot from a police rifle. Police gunfire wounds 14 strikers and 2 pickets. Striker Robert Mamera is shot in the leg and the hip. Gigmo takes a bullet to the shins. A young strike supporter who works for the streetcar company is hit twice in the belly. Nearly 3,000 spectators have gathered outside the plant, most of them sympathetic to the union. Ruth arrests anyone with a car to park it on Chevrolet Avenue to block the police from resuming their attack. "Go home and get your guns," Ruth beseeches through the sound car megaphone. "Don't give up. Keep on fighting. We have reinforcements on the way from Toledo and Akron to help you fight these guys." Despite this call to arms, there are never guns inside the plants. Travis doesn't want to give the cops another excuse to use violence. That's Bob Travis, the UAW organizer. The wounded men are taken to a restaurant, then driven to Hurley Hospital in ambulances and private cars. Inside the plants, women press wet towels against the faces of tear gas men. The corporation has charged the sit-downers with disregard for the property. Bellows Ruther has become both field lieutenant and Greek chorus for the conflict. But it is General Motors who tonight, through the city police, have destroyed property. All during these days, the Fisher Body workers have been sitting down peacefully protecting their jobs. Yes, and religiously guarding the machines in which they earn their livelihood. Not a scratch has marred a single object in the plant until tonight when the police shot their gas and bullets into it in a cowardly attack upon these unarmed and peaceful men. What could they do but defend themselves as best they could? They must now fight not only for their jobs, but their very lives. Let General Motors be warned, however. The patience of these men is not inexhaustible. If there's further bloodshed here tonight, we will not be responsible for what the workers do in their rage. There are costly machines in that plant. Let the corporation and their thugs remember that. Janora Johnson asks Ruther if she too can address the crowd from the sound car. He hands her the microphone. "These men had no firearms," Johnson shouts. "They were defenseless in the face of firearms. I ask all the women here tonight to come down and stand with your husbands and brothers. If the police are cowards enough to shoot down defenseless men, they're cowards enough to shoot down women. Women of the city of Flint, break through these police lines and come down here and stand with your husbands and your brothers, your sons and your sweethearts." In response to Johnson's exhortation, women surge toward the plant. As they pass through the police lines, one has her overcoat torn off by a cop, but the police don't stop the women, nor do they fire again once there's a danger of hitting one. Having been repulsed once and facing a hostile crowd, the police hold their position on the bridge, only occasionally to save face, lobbing a gas bomb that illuminates the sky above the plant. The Flint police run out of gas shells at midnight. They appeal to Detroit for more, but are told that none can be spared. Sheriff Wolcott himself halts an attempt to distribute rifles for a second attack. "There's going to be no shooting here," he tells Chief Wills. "I'm the leading law enforcement officer in the county during any troubles, and those are my orders."
Great. So tell us, I mean, naturally, ultimately, there is a resolution of the strike.
Yeah.
And there is no more violence, though there are memorable events, you know, than a different
sit-down. There is more violence when they took over Chevy 4, but there's no more shooting like that. Well, the result of that was that, you know, of course, as soon as Governor Murphy heard about this, he immediately went to Flint in the middle of the night. And he sent the National Guard to Flint. And as I said, he could have legally used the National Guard to expel the workers from the plants because there was that court injunction that said they were trespassing, but he decided that he was going to use the National Guard to keep order to prevent another outbreak of violence in Flint. So he just said, "I want you to set up between outside the plants, form a defensive perimeter outside the plants and make sure that the police and the strikers don't go at it again." So I think that there were as many as 2,000 National Guardsmen in Flint. They were, you know, they were camping out. They were setting up inside a junior high school. And I mentioned one of the officers was Bryce Custer, who was the grandnephew of, from Monroe, who was the grandnephew of the famous General Custer. Murphy thought he had worked out, he got both sides to come to Lansing and he thought he'd worked out an agreement, but then The strikers found out that they were also going to, the company was also going to negotiate with this group called the Flynn Alliance, which was sort of an anti-strike group that had been founded by some of the local business community, and you know, they had expected to be the exclusive bargaining agent. So that ruined the Lansing Agreement, and eventually the federal government had to step in. Francis Perkins tried to get Alfred P. Sloan and John L. Lewis in the same room, and there's just some great conversations between Sloan and Perkins, which I found. She gave an oral history to Columbia University towards the end of her life, and she talked a lot about the sit-down strike. It was a very significant moment in her secretaryship at the Department of Labor, and I mean, maybe I can read a little how their relationship finally broke down when she thought she had an agreement with him, and he backed to talk to the union, talk to the strikers, and he backed out. And she says, when he says that, she says, "You don't deserve to be counted among decent men. Decent people don't do such things. You'll go to hell when you die if you do things like that. You have let people down. You betrayed your government. You betrayed the men who work for you. You betrayed your stockholders. Are you a grown man, Mr. Sloan, or are you a neurotic adolescent? If you're a grown man, stand up and be a man for once." And of course, I mean, she really would be out of line talking to any American citizen like this, much less the chairman of General Motors. And he says, "You can't talk to me like that. You can't talk to me like that. I'm Alfred Sloan. I've got $70 million. I made it all myself. You can't talk to me like that." She says, "Have you ever read what happens to the rich man? It's like the camel trying to go through the eye of the needle. If you've got $70 million, it's going to drown you, Mr. Sloan. It's going to sink you. For God's sake, don't say those words to me again. It makes for you a worse rotter than I thought you were." And I made sure to mention at the end that Sloan was the namesake of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I didn't want him just to be nothing but an antagonist. And you know, unlike many auto executives of that period, he doesn't have his name on a car.
Right.
So not like Henry Ford or Walter Chrysler. So he's not remembered. He's not remembered that way.
So what, since you're really talking about Perkins and things that she said that might be regarded as in the day, frankly, outside of her gender.
Yeah.
Janora Johnson gets often the same type of history.
These are
very strong women. Can you talk
right.
a little bit more about gender and the role of women, and also the role of race? Because the role
yeah.
of race is something that we often don't spend a lot of time talking about in relation.
Right. Well, you know, women. There were women working in the cut and sew department at Fisher One, but they were as soon as the sit down started, they were told to leave. Because the strikers didn't want the company talking about what might have been going on between men and women in the plant there. And Janora Johnson, she was somebody who had, you know, had a long history in the socialist movement. She'd brought socialist speakers to Flint. I think she was, you know, better informed and better educated than most factory wives. And when she went down to the Pengelly building to volunteer, they said, "Okay, well, we'll put you in the kitchen." And she wanted to do more than be in the kitchen. So first she started a picket line, and her son, there's a picture of her son carrying a placard that says, "My daddy strikes for us little tykes." And then after the Battle of the Running Bulls, she started the Women's Emergency Brigade, and they were going to be a paramilitary organization, and they were going to, you know, be there, and they were going to put their bodies on the line when there was any trouble for their men. And they all wore red berets, and they wore armbands, and they carried billy clubs underneath their long coats. And they went into action when the strikers decided to capture Chevy 4, they sort of had a misdirection. They were going to pretend to capture Chevrolet 9, and the plant police fired tear gas inside that plant, and the Women's Emergency Brigade broke all the windows to let the tear gas escape. And so they were in the New York Times the next day, you know, crazed, or the Flint Journal, you know, crazed women breaking windows. And I know some people, there is a, at the Sit Down Strikers Memorial outside, I think it's UAW Region 1D, there is a statue of a woman doing that, breaking a window with a billy club. And some people have suggested that there should be a statue of Janora Johnson in downtown Flint, just like David Buick and you know, Billy Durant.
So talk a little bit about race, by the way.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, you know, I think that there had been these federally unions, these federally sponsored unions, and I think that a lot of the black workers felt like they were kind of segregated. When Wyndham Mortimer went out of his way to try to organize the black workers, and he had a secret meeting with black workers. You know, they were, most of them worked in the Buick foundry. You know, that was the dirtiest job in the plant. And they had a secret meeting at this spiritualist church. And they asked him, you know, we're not really included in all the activities of these federal unions. And he said, no, we're not a Jim Crow union. We're not, you know, everybody's equal in the UAW. And then I have a picture in the book of a guy named Roscoe Van Zant, and he was a sanitation worker. And when Chevy 4 was captured, he was kind of trapped inside, and he agreed to join the occupation. And when the strike ended, his fellow strikers elected him to carry the American flag to lead all the workers out of the plant. And I think you can certainly say that you know, the auto plants were really important in you know, building a black middle class. I mean, a lot of African Americans moved up to Michigan from the South specifically to work in the auto plants. And, you know, it was a place where whites and blacks worked side by side. I mean, I like to think that's one reason Lansing was so integrated, but, you know, they did the same in Detroit and it didn't really work there. So maybe there's another reason. Lansing was very integrated, and you know, when I went to school, it seemed like it was half black and half white, and nobody seemed to have a problem with busing.
So, help us understand, Ted. You know, there's a lot of remarkable people that were connected to this. Who, when you look at your history of the Flint sit-down strike, who did you find most remarkable or most surprising as you were writing the book?
Well, I should give credit. There's a guy, you may know a guy named Neil Layton. Do you know him?
Yeah.
Yeah, he led an effort in the late 70s and early 80s to conduct oral histories with sit-down strikers. And some of them are online at the U of M Flint Labor History Project, but a lot of them are just in boxes at the U of M Flint Library. So I had to go through them and make copies. But you know, here are the voices of the sit down strikers. You know, all these guys are dead. That's another reason I wanted to write the book, because there's nobody left alive to tell the story. I mean, Bob Travis was an interesting character. I mean, to me, he just had a story that was just kind of out of a Steinbeck novel, you know, growing up and, you know, working 12-hour days on a farm in Indiana and trying to form a union and getting fired and, you know, going out west on the railroads and joining the Wobblies. And actually, his daughter has just contacted me. She's been reading the book. She said she bought 20 copies for her friends. So that's a great reader. So they, you know, he was a, and he had been working in Toledo when they asked him to take over, and he thought it was too big of a job for him. So, you know, and he was just such a, he was a great tactician. He was the one who came up with the plan to capture Fisher Chevy 4 by making the company think that they were trying to capture Chevy 9 and sending all the plant police over that way. So he was a fascinating character. There was a guy named Francis O'Rourke who kept a strike diary that I republished many excerpts from it in the book. I think you were saying before that this was about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. They did something that the whole world kept its eyes on, and that had not just nationwide, but worldwide implications. You know, a lot of these guys had worked in an auto, they were auto workers, and when it was over, they went back to being auto workers. But for 6 weeks, they had the eyes of the nation on them.
Well, one way, and then I'd like to open it up, and I've got other questions as well, but tell us a little bit about kind of the before and after story.
Yeah.
What was it like before the strike? And for those auto workers going back to their jobs, what was it like afterward?
Before the strike, there was no job security. I mean, they used to say that the foreman could fire you anytime he wanted and put his brother-in-law to work in your place. And so strikers had to, you know, do whatever they could. And because there was a depression on, people were so desperate for jobs, you know, strikers had to paint the boss's house or bring him food or throw him a party. And, you know, the women said, if the foreman got fresh with you, you know, what could you do? You couldn't do anything. They said to do whatever they wanted. There was this speed up that was a big source of discontent where, they might start the day at 40 cars an hour, and by the, you know, if they were running behind on quota, they would run it up to 60 cars an hour, and the line would just break down because it wasn't engineered to run that fast. And the men would be so exhausted, they'd go home, and all they could do was put a fork to their mouths and then go to sleep. And, you know, their wives got tired of how grouchy they were because of the pace of labor. And, you know, that's kind of how I ended the story was, you know, after the settlement, there were seniority rules. They had to do, you know, time studies before they could make the line run faster. And I mean, workers felt like they were more respected. I think that this strike wasn't about money. It was about respect and it was about dignity. And there was a worker who said that, you know, before the strike, his foreman, whenever he complained, his foreman took him to the window and pointed outside and said, look at those line of people out there. Those are people who want your job. And, we'll give it to them if you keep complaining. And they said that just wasn't happening anymore.
Okay. Well, let me open it up, Ted, to other folks in terms of any questions that they have. And okay. Then I ultimately want to come back specifically to have you talk about the epilogue and are the lessons for today in the strike. But let me open it up for comments or questions from anyone. Just please... just unmic and ask your question. Anyone want in? Mark?
I'd love to ask a couple of questions. First, okay. I'll start with the Lansing question.
All right.
You grew up next door to the Ketchums?
Not next door, but I mean, they lived in East Lansing and we lived in Lansing.
Because I was wondering if he had a son named Mark Ketchum.
He might have. He didn't have any. He had some stepchildren or adopted children. He didn't have any actual children of his own, so
the reason why I ask is that Mark, I worked with Mark Ketchum at Fisher Body in the paint department, and Mark Ketchum was one of the most financially adept line workers there was in the
really?
Whole plant. And so when you said his dad wrote out a check for $14,000 for somebody's dental stuff, I thought maybe that financial acumen had passed through their family.
Oh, well, I don't know. He said one reason he did it was his stepkids never paid any attention to him, so he might as well give the money to somebody else. So, I honestly don't know if he had a son named Mark.
Well, another question I'd like to ask is with regard to your article you wrote on the 2nd of February, where you tie the lessons from the sit-down strike to the current situation in the labor movement.
Yeah. Well, what's been amazing to me is, you know, reading about this labor organizing effort going on in Alabama at the Amazon plant is how similar their concerns are to what the concerns of the sit-down strikers are. You know, they've been complaining about sort of an inhumane, you know, quotas, unrealistic quotas, an inhumane pace of labor. They've been complaining about job security. They've been complaining about not having enough say in the workplace. And so, you know, we're doing this all over again 85 years later. You know, Amazon, you know, I always said that the greatest victory of the anti-labor movement hasn't been in destroying existing unions. It's been in preventing the unionization of industries that, you know, took the place of industrial labor. You know, there's been a feeling that in private industry, you know, only factories should be unionized. So, but I think that Amazon almost occupies the place the GM may have in the 1930s. I mean, it's one of the world's largest companies, and especially since the pandemic started, if people are ordering so much stuff online, if Amazon shut down, then commerce in America would shut down. And I know that some of the, in Chicago, there was some labor discontent over working conditions and working safety as a result of COVID, and they were able to get safer working conditions. So I'm hoping that, you know, a lot of these workers who are finding out that they're essential are going to demand some compensation for being so important in this pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Question?
I shared your article with some of the local leaders in town here, because
local,
I thought that article really resonated. So
are you a UAW official?
I was. I'm retired now, and I still do some stuff.
Right. You worked at Fisher Body?
I worked there, yes. I worked on the assembly line for 16 years. I was a local union official for 12 years, and I worked for the International Union for 12 years.
Were you ever one of the guys? One thing I just remember so much from high school is whenever we had a football game, there'd be guys across the street standing up in the balcony watching the game. Did you ever do that?
Oh, yeah. Right where the paint department was, where I worked.
Was it?
And Alan Haller and some of the other Sexton stars you might recall.
Yeah, Alan Haller, he played briefly in the NFL.
Right, he played.
I think he was either in my class or a year after me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay.
We used to stand out there occasionally. We couldn't watch the whole game or anything, but it was a big game especially. You go out on your break or at lunch hour, lunch hours then were after the games ended, though.
Right.
But, you know, you got a couple of breaks. We'd go out on the roof and watch.
Right. Did you ever go over to Gus's?
Oh, yeah. Gus's and Chop Stop and all those places.
Yeah, Harry's is still there. My dad and I love to go to Harry's. I wrote about Gus's in that book, Nothing But Blue Skies. It's closed now, but I met Gus.
See, things I shouldn't tell you, but since, you know, this is only being recorded. Occasionally on a hot night in the trim department, we would climb up the racks of inventory they had.
Yeah.
Toss a rope out a window. Somebody would run over to Gus's and buy a six-pack, attach it to the rope. We'd haul it up and have a beer inside the plant at lunch.
Oh, yeah. Well, I read Ben Hamper's book.
Clearly against the rules.
He talked about all that stuff going on at GM. So
yeah.
It sounds like it was going on in every – well, we were banned from Safeway. Our principal banned us from
That's going right. There. I remember the sign.
Yeah, because you – well, did Safeway ban us too? I mean, the principal didn't want us in there. Because I think you guys were just right.
Safeway said no more than two students at a time.
Oh, yeah, because I think that's where you guys were going for all your beer. So they didn't want us to get run over.
I have one other question on a more serious note. In 1979, I had a chance to go to the Pioneers reunion in Flint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to hear Janora speak. And then I got to witness something that I found was wildly interesting was that even in 1979, they were still reliving the split between the socialists and the communists.
Really?
And people tend to look at the sit-down strike as this great time of solidarity and everybody was united. But they argued with such veracity, and this is 40 years after the sit-down strike.
Well, that's what's
amazing to see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Socialists and communists seem to hate members of other socialist and communist factions even more than they hate capitalists.
Well, let me open it up to other questions. I see Bruce, you seem to be on mic.
I am. Yeah.
Do you have a question?
No.
Hi, Bruce.
All his activities in Flint, right?
Yeah. Although, so there were negotiations in Lansing. I tried to mention Lansing as many times as possible because nobody's ever really written a book about Lansing because it's not as... although I did write, I do have a novel coming out, actually. I think it's next month. I like to say it's a fictional update of the fictional sequel to the sit-down strike. It's called Running for Home. It's being published by Bottom Dog Press in Ohio. They specialize in Midwestern working class fiction. It's the only, and it's about the main character is a high school cross country runner, which I was, and the plant is shutting down and his dad has to decide whether he's going to take the transfer to Tennessee and break the family apart. And his grandfather was, a striker, and some of the conflicts between the generations there. Well, so that, and it's based on Lansing, although, Lansing just, I would say that for a town that peaked at just under 200,000, Flint has had an outsized role in American history. But, you hear there's a lot more written about Flint and Detroit than there is about Lansing in Michigan.
And Bob Stein has a question. Bob?
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the role of the communists and socialists in the sit-down strike.
Well, they were behind it. Bob Travis, he had been involved in Wyndham Mortimer, the original organizer. They bounced him for being a communist, but Bob Travis, who took over, he had been involved with the Communist Party before. And there was a guy named Henry Krauss who wrote a book, probably maybe the first book about the sit-down strike, a book called The Many and the Few. And I use that for some of the dialogue I have in there. And he came up from Cleveland, and he ran a paper called The Flint Auto Worker. I think he had been involved with the Communist Party. So, the Ruthers, they were socialists. They had worked in Soviet auto plants in the 1930s before coming back to the United States. I mean, they probably got out just in time because I think Stalin executed some foreign auto workers because he thought they were an outsider, a foreign influence on good Bolsheviks. I would say that they played a major role in the sit-down strike.
Well, and I think one of the things that you mentioned in the book, and it's often been reprised, is the whole notion that since Janora and the rest of the Women's Emergency Brigade wore red berets.
Yeah, well, some women didn't like that because they thought it was suggestive of communism. Janora, she was a socialist. She had bought socialist speakers to Flint before. Let me see if I can... Who did she bring? Who did she bring to speak in Flint? She brought Norman Thomas to speak in Flint. He was the Socialist Party candidate for president of the United States 6 times.
Other questions? Anyone want to jump in before I ask a couple of others? Ted, I think that Mark really teed you up by talking about the article. So if you had any advice for young people in relation to looking back at, is there people, what do you say to Amazon workers? What do you say to Walmart workers? You mentioned them in your epilogue. What do you really believe they need to understand?
Well, that, if they, I think I said that the blueprint for a new union movement is in this in this book. I mean, it's probably not as easy for them to carry off a sit-down strike as it was for the workers in Flint, because, you know, if you sit down in one Walmart, all the other Walmarts are going to keep operating. Whereas, you know, in Flint, they were able to sit down in one factory and, you know, shut down the world's largest corporation. I mean, one thing I would say just to anybody is, I think one of the lessons of the book is that when, you know, the government takes the side of working people, then, you know, working people succeed. I think, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Francis Perkins, and Frank Murphy, all were on the side of the sit-down strikers. You know, Roosevelt thought, you know, what they were doing was illegal, and he kind of deplored it. But at the same time, he wasn't going to use violence to settle the strike. So I think when government makes those decisions, then working people can thrive. But we really haven't seen government making those decisions in the last 40 years. And there's no reason, you know, people used to say that working in a factory was unskilled labor. I mean, you know, there were people who shoveled coal into boilers in steel mills. And I can't think of anything more unskilled than that, but they made enough money to buy houses and buy cars, you know. So anybody telling you that your work is unskilled and therefore you're not entitled to a fair share of what your company is producing, I mean, that's just, I guess, an ex post facto acknowledgement of the fact that they're able to prevent you from unionizing and demanding that fair share.
Let me just mention two things, Ted, because of fact, I think one thing that comes out in the book is really the fact that Roosevelt, and this is probably, you know, kind of a phenomena that we've seen in various times in American history, was believing that states' rights, that Murphy had, it was Murphy's state.
Yeah.
And right. That therefore, you know, that Michigan should come up with a result from a Michigan point of view, rather than the federal government, in effect, stepping in.
Yeah, well, you know, there was an argument in the cabinet about that, and his vice president, Garner, who was this kind of conservative Texas landowner, he said, why don't they just kick these workers out of the plant? And Roosevelt said, well, I'm not gonna tell the governor of Michigan what to do. And he didn't like to get involved in labor disputes. You know, he had a secretary of labor for that, but he did end up making a phone call to a GM executive to encourage him to sit down with John L. Lewis. And I think that GM thought of its place in the American hierarchy as such that they were only going to take orders directly from the president himself. So because of that, Roosevelt had to put himself out there.
You know, and one thing, just we've got people on the Zoom who know the law maybe just as well, if not better than me. Mm-hmm. But bear in mind, if sit-down striking was ruled unconstitutional, was ruled not to be an allowable use of power, mm-hmm. In the late 30s.
Right.
Now, it's been used since. That is, that we've actually had, there was a successful sit-down strike just a decade and a half ago. At a window manufacturer in Chicago.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
To stop the plant from closing.
Yeah.
And they were actually successful. But the interesting thing about the history of labor law has been now for all of these decades that each time something really shows great promise,
uh-huh.
chances are it's going to be ruled to be an illegal use of labor power.
It was ruled illegal when they were doing it, and
it was ruled to be an unfair labor. But it was that you couldn't be a legitimate union
Right.
That tactic. That's, I guess, okay. But ultimately, the change of the law.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the court ruled that they were trespassing. GM had a right to expel them, and I think that their argument was, well, we work here, so you know, we were legally allowed into the plant. So how can our presence here be illegal? Which was their argument at the time.
Other questions or comments for Ted on the book? Let me just say that, as Ted mentioned, the sit-down fever, as it was called after Flint, took place in a variety of different locations across the United States. Mm-hmm. And the Woolworths, very famously, in downtown Detroit. We had a variety of other places. The first actual modern sit-down in 1934 was actually in the rubber industry. And there was an earlier sit-down actually in auto back in 1915 when the Industrial Workers of the World sat down at Studebaker. So indeed, it's an interesting bit of history. Now, if you have not put your email address in the chat, please do, because that way I can make sure that you get notices of further stuff coming up. Let me just tell you again that next Tuesday, Jacob Zumoff is coming to be part of our series talking about the Passaic Strike, 1926. It's not like we're normally this strike happy, by the way, in terms of thing, but it just so happens we have two in a row. Tonight, Ted is going to be speaking via Zoom for the Ariel's Museum lecture series, similar to today, but I'll make sure that Ted and I have different things to talk about tonight, perhaps some of the same. I cannot thank you enough all for
thank
coming.
You.
And it's great seeing all of you. So, Ted, see you a little later today.
Yeah, let me, is my email address, because if anybody buys the book and wants a signed book plate, they can get in touch with me.
Why don't you put your email address in the chat so everyone can see that?
Yeah, okay. And so we're going to do this again tonight.
Yep. And Ted's book is wonderful. I commend it to all of you. And keep those cards and letters coming in. And I look forward to seeing you at the next Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. Thanks.
All right.